You're listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM, Port Townsend. I'm Larry Stein. There's a relatively new phrase that has come into our vocabulary in the last few years. Citizen science. It's you doing your bird watching and recording your sightings on the website eBird. Or it's your participation in tide pool surveys organized by the Marine Science Center or the WSU Extension. Or you can even be in your own backyard, systematically observing bees or spiders or squirrels. Citizen Science, Searching for Heroes in an Age of Extinction, is a new book by Mary Ellen Hannibal, a San Francisco-based writer who focuses on the natural world and our place in it. Mary Ellen is coming to Port Townsend this week to talk about citizen science in two presentations. She'll be at the Port Townsend High School's monthly salon lecture this Friday, December 9th at 2, and then she'll appear again on Sunday through the Port Townsend Marine Science Center at the Fort Warden Chapel at 3 p.m. I spoke with Mary Ellen Hannibal from her home base in San Francisco. Citizen Science is her fifth book.
When I started writing this, or I started researching this book about citizen science, I was motivated to do so by working on my previous book, which is called The Spine of the Continent. And The Spine of the Continent is an overview of conservation biology, which is really only, about 35 years old. And I tell the story through a profile of Michael Soule, who is the father of conservation biology, and came up with E.O. Wilson and Paul Ehrlich and Jared Diamond and other names you know. They codified what is happening to nature that is, you know, undermining it and causing extinctions to accelerate past a normal rate. And now it's very, very high. It's actually terrifyingly high. And I was also then reporting on efforts along the spine of the continent, which is from Alaska to Mexico along the Rocky Mountains, to save nature, and I profiled some animals and what they're up against. Pikas, which are these little rabbit relatives that live in the high alpine talus slopes on mountains, and they're losing their habitat due to climate change. Jaguars, which are coming back north from Mexico up into Arizona, and the struggles that they confront. And, you know, I really learned a lot about why we need a healthy suite of species on the landscape to be the underpinning of all health for human life as well as natural life. And I also saw that all of that biodiversity is under siege, essentially, by human impacts. And I also saw in The Spine of the Continent that the efforts of nonprofits to really protect nature are valiant, but they're completely insufficient, and they will never save enough nature. So I was asking myself, well, what could scale to address the problem? Where is there a bright spot? Where is there something really working here? So I was introduced to citizen science when I was researching The Spine of the Continent, but it wasn't really called citizen science. In about 2012, citizen science as a concept kind of was bubbling up into not the pure scientific journals, but media around nature. And citizen science is regular people contributing to scientific research and regular people being out on the land and on the water, on the coast, and helping figure out what is going on with nature and what does it need. So then I said, okay, this is working. Citizen science is working. And I went on a project in Mexico with the Sky Island Alliance. It's a nonprofit in Tucson. And what they do is they take people to Mexico to be trained in wildlife tracking. And then the people come back to Tucson and they get a transect assigned to them and they start monitoring it. And over time, their monitoring shows patterns of where big cats, essentially ocelots and jaguar, are using the landscape. Jaguar are on the endangered species list, so that means that the state of Arizona is by law enjoined to create habitat for them to exist there. But where should that habitat be? They've been extirpated from almost all of the United States for quite some time, although they used to live as far north as Monterey here in California, and they're coming north as the climate is changing. So with this data from citizens, we could see these large pictures of where the animals are actually using the landscape, and that's really helped define where those protected areas should be. I also saw that the data that citizens collected is being used by the Department of Transportation in Arizona to locate wildlife overpasses to help wildlife cross the road without getting hit by cars. And so there was this one element of citizen science, which is more eyes on the ground than we have possibly enough scientists to do that. But then the other thing that really intrigued me when I was with the Sky Island of people is that I was with a group of people that were from all walks of life, a prison guard, a school teacher, a software engineer, and there were Republicans and Democrats. Nobody really discussed anything like that, and we all really just worked together completely entranced with what we were learning about how jaguar use the landscape and how to track them. We need so much more data than we have about where exactly species are and how they're using the landscape. And there are not enough scientists to make those observations themselves. And then secondarily, we need to get past the things that divide us about the environment. I hate to say this, but I think it's true that we really need to actually show people the impacts of extinction and the impacts of losing populations of species. So when I said, I'm going to write my next book about citizen science because I think it really can work to save nature, here at the California Academy of Sciences, they said, oh, great, we're starting a citizen science program. Why don't you be embedded as a journalist and watch what we're doing? So I said, great. And their first project is to instigate a monitoring project at Pillar Point. And some citizen science does monitoring, where we take note of what we see where and when in prescribed areas and in prescribed periods of time. Sometimes you just do that for the sake of doing it, but there's a question, a scientific question, essentially, at Pillar Point. Pillar Point is adjacent to a marine protected area, and that has been very carefully documented for a long time by volunteers. So the Academy said, let's document this tide pool that is next to that but is not protected, and let's see what's happening in the protected area versus the unprotected area. And a lot of the data that has been collected, and I'm sure the data that's been collected up where you are too, has been used to determine where we should have more marine protected areas. That's citizen science in conservation action.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I went out with the California Academy of Sciences on their very first monitoring in June of 2012. They picked a couple of sites, so they make a geolocation of a latitude and a longitude point in the tide pool, which they return to every single time they monitor, and then make a transect or pull a tape measure a certain amount of feet all around that center, and then count up the species in that circle. Not all the species, that would take you a long time, but in the case of this project, mostly nudibranchs, which are these wildly psychedelic sea slugs.
Mm-hmm.
They're fabulous.
Mm-hmm.
So we count those, and we were counting sea stars or starfish.
Sea stars, of course, are very much in people's consciousness in terms of the terrible die-off and the terrible, as I understand it, viral disease that has spread across the whole West Coast.
Yes, that's where I was going with this, actually. Thank you for bringing it up, because the first day we went out, we had 70 sea stars in one of the plots and, you know, something like 55 sea stars in the other plot. 2 months later, there were zero in anywhere. And it is the sea star wasting syndrome that, you're right, is caused by a virus. Now, because of monitoring of the coast, which has gone on for decades, we know that that virus has been in the water. Why would it suddenly take out all the sea stars? And this is the biggest marine die-off known to human history. It's pretty petrifying. Nobody really knows why that virus set off the sea star wasting at the time that it did. And there's all kinds of factors, of course. There's ocean acidification, there's pollution, there's climate change, and then there's plain old changes to the ecosystem because of the way that humans have interacted with it.
Mm-hmm.
It's very important to keep monitoring those transects. There's been some juvenile sea stars that people have been observing. The question is, are those juveniles going to grow and thrive, or are they going to succumb to the virus also?
Mm-hmm.
So this is a beautiful case of citizen science, because if you think about the whole West Coast, I mean, it's just gigantic, right? How can mm-hmm. you possibly monitor the whole West Coast of North America, essentially. Well, you can do it if you have citizen scientists out there doing it.
Mm-hmm. Are there groups of citizen scientists along the whole length of the coast? I mean, you're talking about San Francisco and the Bay Area. I know there's much activity up here in the Northwest around Seattle.
There's kind of a panoply of a lot of different kinds of monitoring that goes along the coast. It's a pretty complicated world because there are professional, serious, governmental monitoring of the coast goes on. And so there's governmental agencies, state agencies that monitor as well. And then there are nonprofit groups and citizen scientists that do also. And if you're a regular person and you don't even belong to a group or even want to, you don't have to join in. Mm-hmm. To help monitor the sea star wasting, you can just use this app called iNaturalist. And you put this app on your phone, and what you do is you make a photographic observation when you see a species, not just a sea star, but any species. The app assigns the photograph a date, a time, a latitude, and a longitude. And then you might not know what you have just taken a picture of, like you don't know which species of sea star that is. And basically, it's like a Facebook feed for nature lovers, mm-hmm. and these photographs and their IDs go up on this continuous feed. And contributors who are scientists, naturalists, or just fantastic amateurs will identify that for you. When there's an agreement from the crowd, crowdsourced agreement basically, that yes, that is whatever kind of sea star you said it was or thought it was, then that piece of data gets uploaded to GBIF. GBIF is the acronym, and it's basically a digital museum of specimens from all around the world. And with that data, then scientists and natural resources managers and municipalities, anybody who needs to get a picture of what's going on in nature in a location, can use GBIF pretty easily to get a picture of what's the biodiversity somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So one thing about iNaturalist is people are kind of out there maybe thinking, I need to find something strange and unusual to photograph. But it's actually just as important to photograph and upload extremely ordinary plants and animals, bugs, birds, because those things are changing as well.
Mm-hmm.
And where they are changing and how is really the signature of how these impacts are affecting life on Earth.
Now, what this opens up, of course, is something that I've heard discussed in varied areas. I mean, in the world of the naturalist and in the world, I recently heard a discussion of this in the world of medical research. I mean, the explosion of data, of information that is coming in from all sources, aided by computers, aided by technology, and aided by citizen scientists to some degree. That's an incredible explosion of information to process. So that opens a whole new problem in terms of this. I mean, what do we do with all this data that we're collecting, and how are we set to analyze it?
Well, it's a wonderful question. It goes to the heart of what preoccupies quite a few people who are mm-hmm. in the citizen science world that very, very much train their intelligence and their energies on this exact question. And the answer is there's just a lot being done. There's a totally widespread agreement that we need to have data that all goes to centralized databases, and so it all needs to be collected in a way that's usable by that database. It's really super important to use existing citizen science databases like iNaturalist or eBird. Something called Nature's Notebook is a wonderful one. It's a project of the National Phenology Network. So the National Phenology Network includes observations taken by Thomas Jefferson of blooming and bird migrating and animals coming out of hibernation. Phenology is basically nature's timing events, and of course those are changing with climate change. But if you use Nature's Notebook or iNaturalist or eBird, your data is going into these highly vetted databases where they can be used. So if I'm sitting here in my backyard and I decide I want to monitor bees and my next door neighbor wants to monitor bees and neither of us uses the Great Sunflower Project, which is a place to put your data where I suggest you do if you want to monitor bees, and I decide that I'm going to look at how many bees come to a plant for 7 minutes a day, and my next door neighbor decides that he is going to monitor where bees go to flowers in his garden for 10 minutes a day, our data sets are completely incompatible, and they cannot actually be used together. But if we both follow the protocols of the Great Sunflower Project, then our data is completely usable and very easily created into maps. So mapping is kind of like the kissing cousin of citizen science.
Yeah.
In fact, we could even call it citizen mapping,
yeah,
because that's what the data goes to do a lot.
Yeah.
So one of the success stories of The Spine of the Continent, my previous book, is called The Path of the Pronghorn. And The Path of the Pronghorn is one of the final remaining migration pathways of a single herd of pronghorn antelope up in Jackson Hole. And some scientists were studying these antelope, and they noticed that suddenly they seemed to be getting hit by cars all the time. There was this massive uptick in their mortality because fracking had just been invented right nearby. And when fracking started in the area, in come huge trucks, and they interrupted this path of the pronghorn with all of this construction. And the pronghorn are used to going on this circle, this big circle, every year. And they're kind of OCD. Not all animals are like this, but they don't want to just take a left and walk around something. They just keep trying to go on the pathway their ancestors have gone on for 6,000 years at least. So these scientists started an effort to protect the path of the pronghorn, and it took several years. They got nonprofits and regular people whose houses were on the path of the pronghorn, and they determined exactly where the path of the pronghorn is. So they mapped the path of the pronghorn. But that's everybody with cameras out, wildlife camera traps, and tracking, and it was very laborious to actually make this line on the map of where the pronghorn go. But they did it, and they got it protected. It's the only animal movement with protection that has enforceable protection in the United States, which is really, it's a wonderful template. It's what we need to do for a lot of species.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just one of these amazing things. The good news is that technology has given us the most incredible tool to help us protect nature.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole concept of this, by the way, goes back, you know, citizen science itself goes back at least as far as Aristotle in the Western world. There's a big chapter in my book about traditional ecological knowledge and indigenous cultural knowledge, and that, of course, that goes back much farther. And it is a kind of citizen science because it's based on direct observation and experience. But Darwin, when Darwin was figuring out, he was a citizen scientist. He did go to college, but he did not have an advanced degree, and he never worked for anyone. He married into the Wedgwood family, so he was wealthy.
Okay.
That's why he was able to be Darwin. You know, he figured out where the Galapagos, as this kind of template of watching evolution in action, because he figured out that the animals and plants that got there had gotten there over time, that these islands were what they called de novo. They were volcanic islands that had come fairly recent arrivals into the terrestrial environment. And then very slowly, their plants and animals had reached there. And it's kind of like baby steps of life there, mm-hmm, at the Galapagos. You know, we have much more abundant biodiversity development in other parts of the world that have been around longer. So it's really figuring out where are the animals and plants and what amounts that gives us a picture of what is nature comprised of. And then, of course, with climate change and other anthropogenic impacts, we are changing that so fast. We're changing the rate at which animals and plants have to move and how they have to adapt. And they have to adapt to us in large measure because we are so super abundant on the planet. And you will have, I'm sure you will have listeners saying, why doesn't she talk about population explosion,
yeah,
as the problem,
yeah,
that we all face? You are correct. It is population overpopulation of humans for the resources we have available, for sure. But when you go out with iNaturalist, you are doing as Darwin did and observing species where you see them, and then you can use maps online to even visualize and start to think about the patterns that you're seeing.
So iNaturalist and eBird and these online clearinghouses or organizational tools that you use to do your citizen science, are they, how are they supported? Now, there's an infrastructure of these groups that need support. Do these receive government support, research support?
We need to think about how we support more citizen science, because it does cost some money. It's a lot cheaper than setting up big, huge professional monitoring systems, but it still costs something. Now, eBird, this is a project of the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, and it really is sort of the mother of citizen science in the United States, especially because birders have been contributing their data in such large amounts for years and years that we have these incredible data sets of where birds are. And if you want to see something really fun, go on the website of the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, and they have some data visualizations of bird migrations. So these are the little movies that you can watch on your computer.
Right.
You know, you'll watch a shadow of light going across the United States, going up it and then back down it. And those are the migration patterns of single species of birds. And all of those points of light, all of those are based on citizen science observations made by regular people. Although we must say that maybe birders are not regular people.
Well, I think birders
are so avid.
I think I'll have some of our local birders testify to that, and maybe I'll follow them around, because I've heard it from them, right, from them directly.
Yes. They're superb at observing.
And iNaturalist, is that also?
iNaturalist is housed right now at the California Academy of Sciences.
In San Francisco.
Supported by them.
Tell me, let's just sidetrack a little bit to what you're going to be talking about in Port Townsend. I know you're going to be talking to a high school group. It's a series called Friday Salons. I'm not sure if it's just high school or high school and junior high level. On Friday the 9th, and then you're speaking through the Port Townsend Marine Science Center on Sunday.
Well, in both cases, I will talk about this general concept of citizen science and why it is so important. I will explain how what you do as an individual has regional, continental, and even global impact, basically because we can view patterns at these different scales when we take these kinds of observations. In both cases, I'll talk about, you know, the sixth mass extinction that's going on right now, and also explain that as bad as losing individual species like polar bears, we are losing vertebrates, for example, that's birds and animals with backbones, at a shocking and absolutely unsustainable rate. The World Wildlife Fund just about a month ago released their data showing that in the last 40 years, we've lost like 50% of all bodies of animals. Mm. Those species are not maybe going extinct entirely, but we're losing these vital pieces of what makes our world habitable. And I have some explanations of how we need those bodies and what the interactions between species are that make life work. Mm-hmm. So that's why you need bugs, why you need birds, why you need small mammals and large mammals.
Yeah.
And then how humans use energy from the sun. We use energy differently than the way animals and plants do, because we don't redistribute it through the ecosystem. Mm-hmm. You know, when a wolf kills a moose, which takes days and with lots of friends, or the pack, that moose carcass doesn't only feed the wolves, it feeds a host of other animals and microbes and birds. And then eventually that carcass goes into the carbon cycle of the soil. And that's literally that predation cycle of mm-hmm. decomposition and eating is not only how you get a rich, abundant earth that provides food for us, but it also creates the temperature that makes life so habitable for us on Earth.
Yeah.
So citizen science is a way for people to put science into their own lives and to put discovery and observation into their own lives in a way that kind of can knit up with their other interests and impulses.
Mary Ellen Hannibal, the award-winning science writer, spoke with me about her new book, Citizen Science, Searching for Heroes in an Age of Extinction. She'll be here to speak on Friday, December 9th at 2 p.m. at the Port Townsend High School's Salon Lecture Series. It's free and open to the public. On Sunday, she'll be speaking for the Marine Science Center at a 3 p.m. appearance at the Fort Warden Chapel. There's an admission fee for this lecture. For KPTZ Radio, I'm Larry Stein. Thanks for listening.